It's the Raleigh James Show.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. We've got 3 hours to spend together, and in the first hour, at least, we're joined by Steve Probst. And Steve Probst has been publishing books since 50 years at least, since 1973, I think was the first one, though we'll find out. And most recently, those old school records, 1,000 selected R&B, rock and roll, and soul 45 RPM singles. So we'll be talking about that in a moment. And the last couple of weeks, of course, we've been reviewing what was the first rock and roll record. I have the original edition, but there is an updated one as well. We'll find out if anything's changed since the last one. So without further ado, we welcome Steve Probst to the Raleigh James Show. Steve, let's see here. I'll get my magic twanger out and put you on a line. So if anybody wants to join Steve, by all means, call 888-876-5593. But welcome, Steve. How are you?
It's been a while, so it's always good to talk with you.
It's been way too long, that's for sure. I was just thinking about that. And, of course, when I got your latest book, well, you knew I stopped what I was doing and started leafing through it. And it is just great. Now, the embarrassing part is within minutes I found something out I never knew. And I'm like, wow, I never knew that. And now I don't remember what it is. So
yeah, it's on page 213. Wait a second. There's no mind reading included with it. So,
but it is terrific. And the first question I had was, how did you narrow it down to 1,000, and why these 1,000?
Well, that's an approximate count. It's at least 1,000. Okay. I rounded it off for just to make it look better on the cover. I don't know. 1,000. Let me. Can I tell you how I came about doing this?
Absolutely.
I was teaching a class at a college, Cal State Long Beach, here in Long Beach, California, to people who are over 50 years old. You have to be 50 or older. One class member was in his late 90s, so that gives you an idea of the age range. And I would put out lists of records that I intended to play each class session, with little blurbs about the history of these records. But during the 8 weeks of this course, an hour and a half each session, I could only play about 200 records total. Yeah. But I had many more records that I wanted to share with the class. So I put together a book to sell to people in the class. You know how professors are. They like to make a little money on the side. And it sold quite well. In fact, it was double the price that I'm charging right now.
Wow.
And I sold out on that publication. So when Genius Publishers came along, they were interested in the idea, and they went through it and corrected all the typos and misuse of the language, that sort of thing, and voila, here it is.
Well, there can't be any misuse of the language. You're talking about R&B records. I mean, we're still wondering what Sweet Words of Pismatology was. So.
Okay, yeah. And I knew Vernon Greene, and we discussed it at length, and I don't think he had too much of an idea either.
I know.
He thought it up.
Well, that was it. I finally got, you know, got in touch with him and talked to him, and I was looking for this great story, and I said, well, what does it mean? He said, I just made it up. Like, oh, God.
Right.
I wanted to hit him.
It worked.
Yeah. Oh, did it ever. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, that's not the only, of course, nonsensical lyric. And then, of course, we get to doo-wop itself. Now, unrelated to the book, but before I go on, you were the one who started the first Southern California Doo-Wop Society, weren't you?
Well, I was involved in its creation. Let me put it that way. It was a offshoot of the radio show I did on KLON out of Long Beach for a decade in the 1980s. And fans of the show thought no one else loved doo-wop except that particular person, but they found out there were many other people that loved doo-wop, and they came together and put together a society that presented, God, I don't know how many, maybe 50 shows in Southern California from the 1980, well, let's see, yeah, late 1980s until, oh, I don't know, 20 years, maybe 30 years later, brought in acts from New York City like the Dubs and the Counts from Indianapolis and lots of local groups and local acts who sadly are no longer with us, like Don Julian and the Meadowlarks and Richard Berry.
I know.
We had Hunter Hancock. We he came in and we presented him a special award. I and a friend of mine drove him in from his nursing home in Montclair. He was up in age then, and here he is on the stage, and people are giving these elaborate speeches about how much they loved him, and I could, and he was standing right in front of me, and I could feel he was getting weaker and weaker because he was, you know, sort of frail at the time. He was really up in years, and he started to collapse, so I sort of had to hold him up as he accepted all the adulation of the crowd.
Well, thank God he lived to hear it, though. As your book points out, in many cases, you can't really talk L.A. records back in the day without talking about Huggy Boy.
And, Huggy Boy.
Yeah, he was one who I don't think ever in many ways got his just due. You know, Art LeBeau was such a big businessman and a wonderful businessman, but Huggy, as you well know and you know firsthand, was anything but a businessman, and I thought he should have been a lot more celebrated than he was.
Well, I think the racetrack had something to do with it.
Why I know that. My favorite story, and you've probably heard it, was, of course, he went away for a year and a day on income tax evasion, and because he didn't pay the money when he would do the concerts. And he actually said to the judge before the sentencing, well, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was supposed to give the government a cut.
And you know, that year and a day, he translated into... when little Julian Herrera came back to El Monte Legion Stadium, Huggy Boy thought up, he's been gone a year and a day, but now he's here to stay.
Right. That was a euphemism for just got out of the joint, you know, because that was it, a year and a day. And, of course, little Julian Herrera was terrific, but I think too many underage girls did him in, if I'm not mistaken.
At Griffith Park, I believe.
Yeah.
It was a place... place to go with your bottle of whatever you're drinking in the evening, and
speaking of that,
use your imagination. Yeah, go ahead.
I had to laugh when I read about All Night Long, because of course anybody from Southern California, particularly who used to be at that club on Lancashire Boulevard where you know, Joe Houston would be doing All Night Long all the time, and your story is just terrific about the All Night Long shout. So tell us about that.
Well, actually, Huggy Boy was involved in that. It was a pretty wild session. There were a couple of, in fact, I wrote a couple of notes about sessions that were more or less drink all you can, and we'll take it from there.
Yeah.
And that was All Night Long. He got some fans together, and Huggy Boy was sort of leading the chant, and... the engineer, his one complaint about the session was you could hear the bottles dropping on the floor. Now another record that was put together in a situation, best resembles a riot, believe it or not, Wally Roker told me this story. You knew Wally,
Sure. Of course.
Great guy. Twist and Shout, the Isley Brothers. That was a gang. Well, not actual gangs, but it was like a gang war. People were fighting throughout the session, and Luther Dixon had to put together the tape. I mean, there were so many takes that were usable, but he was able to blend a session out of that. So those two records have a lot in common, and the circumstances that probably people got hurt or arrested at best.
That is terrific. We're talking to Steve Propes, and by the way, a lot of people call me all the time, ask me questions about records, and compared to Steve, I know absolutely nothing, trust me. So if you have any questions about anything having to do with those old school records, yeah, now's your chance. 888-876-5593 on WGN Radio. James, well, there it is, proof, the power of positive drinking. I always wondered where they got those people screaming all night long. So basically, just inebriated patrons, Huggy Boys friends?
Yeah, I have sort of a impromptu fan club. you know, if I invite you to a session where you know there's going to be a free hooch, it's tough to turn it down, I think. But then again, it's a matter of who you're talking to, I guess.
Well, you know what's so wonderful is that there was so little money involved in this. When we talk sessions, literally, we're talking, you know, tens of dollars or hundreds of dollars at most. And so you could take a chance. You could have a good time. And I think the label owners wouldn't know this stuff if they fell over it. They just wanted a hit. So.
Well, I'll tell you, though, Joe Houston, who went by at times Big Joe Houston and Mighty Joe Houston. Yeah. He actually, physically, he wasn't that big a guy, but he sure blew a major league sacks, tenor sacks. He recorded this for Lovin' John Dolphin of Dolphins of Hollywood on Vernon and Central. And so you're saying you weren't making much. That let me put it this way: he made a lot in personal appearances, record royalties. I think some money is still owed. So he went around to every label that he recorded for. He went to RPM Records and other labels and put down All Night Long all over again. It's sort of hard to discern which version you're listening to. It could be the original on Money Records, Dolphins label. Could be any old label that Joe Houston recorded for. He had that song in his pocket and was willing to share it with whoever called for a session.
I'm so glad you brought up John Dolphin, because, okay. of course, you know, this is one of the best. Firstly, I loved the guy when he came up with Dolphins of Hollywood, because it was such a wonderful pimp, since he wasn't allowed to own a store in Hollywood, that he put one on Central Avenue and call it Dolphins of Hollywood. But yes, he never heard of a royalty he had to pay. And so it was, ultimately, as you well know, he was blown away. Now, when you read about the murder, and you read about all the stories, you read about the disgruntled songwriter who allegedly killed him. I never have found anything about, was this guy tried? Was he sentenced? What happened to him? What did happen to this guy?
Actually, I met a musician who came. He was a friend of Ed Carter, who was a later member of the Medallions, and he sang with him. And I can't think of his name, but he was actually a cellmate of Percy Ivy at Chino Prison. And I asked him to tell me a little bit about Percy Ivy, his cellmate, what Percy had told him. And he said, no, he was my cellmate, and I can't rat on him. So he gave me a lot of great stories about Clarksdale and Elmore James and people like that, but he never shared his experiences with the man who shot Lovin' John Dolphin.
Well, okay, so here's the deal. Was his name Percy Ivy?
Yeah.
Okay, so that, because see, I tried to research this, and I'm not like you, I'm not good at this at all, but I could not come up with any evidence that Percy Ivy existed other than the stories about the murder of John Dolphin. And I thought, well, maybe it was just a nom de plume or something. So his name was Percy Ivy. Do we know, is he a Californian?
That I don't know, because I couldn't get the information
Nothing.
Out of his. I know where he was, where he did his time, Chino Prison, out in, east part of Southern California. I know a little bit about the story, how who was there when he was shot.
Yeah, right, with Bruce Johnson and Sandy Nelson, as I recall.
Yeah, and after the murder. Sandy Nelson was holding a bottle of Pepsi, and he ran out to find a cop and shaking up the Pepsi, and it sprayed all over the place. While I think it was Bruce, could have been Sandy, was talking to Percy after he shot him about collaborating with him as a songwriter.
Yeah.
He was making a deal at the scene. Now that could possibly be apocryphal, but it was, I think Bruce Johnson told me the story.
I wouldn't be in the least surprised about that. But okay, so we know he was in Chino, so at least we know he was a convicted, or he wouldn't have been there. But
a real person.
A real person who was really convicted, and then we don't have any release dates. I mean, I've even gone through the California prison system trying to find him. That's why I thought maybe it wasn't his name.
Well, now I gave you a clue, Chino Prison.
Yes, I will be looking, because that is one of those stories that is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine what Bruce and Sandy, and I think Dave Shostak was there too, had thought when this guy comes in and just kills them, you know.
They were R&B fans. They were fans. They lived in Pacific Palisades, but they were R&B fans, so they came down to the big city to talk to John. Maybe had John not met a early end, he might well have recorded these guys. He might have had the first Beach Boys record. Who knows?
I wouldn't be surprised. And we'll talk about some of those early records. We're talking to Steve Probst. Those Old School Records is the current book, wherever books are sold. I used to link to Amazon, but they stopped me. But you can find it, no doubt about it, and you should find it. Only thing is, when it comes in the mail, don't open it until you've got some time, because you will be reading it. All right, we're going to find out what's going on in the world at large and get right back to it right here on WGN Radio.
Have love. Well, baby, now
James. Of course, that's Richard Berry and the Pharaohs on Flip 1960. And you can't talk about those old rock and roll and rhythm and blues records without talking about Richard Berry. And of course, in those old school records, 1,000 selected R&B, rock and roll, and soul 45 RPM singles, 1946 to 87, Steve Probst has certainly covered the Richard Berry landscape. And I think the story of Richard is one of the saddest things. Of course, in the end, before he died, he got the royalties back. But here he is writing Louie Louie, and well, you know what happened.
I don't know if you know it or not, but I have the chart. That actually charted on KFWV, Color Radio, Top 40. I think the first Top 40, Have Love Will Travel, was like 39 or something like that.
Well, that's great.
So that's encouraging. Richard Berry was a hell of a lovable guy, just a wonderful person. Not much has been written about him. Mm-hmm. He had a chance, pun not intended, he had a chance to sign with Chess Records, but someone, the L.A. Chess guy, vetoed the signing, and I'll never understand why. I'm not going to mention any name.
Yeah.
But I think he would have done well on Chess Records. Anyway, Richard went to Jeff High, and he went to Fremont High, but he was most associated with Jeff, and he met Dorothy, and Dorothy swept his heart away, and he needed some dough to get married, $750. And he'd already recorded Louie Louie, a bit of a local hit in L.A., and well, this record has come and gone. I don't need it anymore. So he sold the rights to his Louie Louie to Max Firetag of Flip Records, his the label owner, for $750 to finance his wedding. Well, the wedding, the marriage didn't last, but guess what about Louie Louie? It sort of had a life of its own.
No kidding. And, you know, I guess technically Max owned the rights, for better or worse. How did finally Richard Berry prevail to get some rights back?
Well, there was a lawyer, Chuck, I think his name was Chuck Rubin. He made a career about obtaining rights for people that had lost them in similar transactions, and was able to help Richard. Of course, he got a rather handsome payday for doing that.
Right.
So everybody won. But yeah, Richard was a millionaire towards the end. But it took a lifetime to restore his rights. Richard was very modest guy, no pretensions. He worked yard parties and did a lot of local appearances, and was one of the best liked people in the Southern California rhythm and blues scene. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Everything.
The Doo-Wop Society did a lot. Well, we didn't do much. Society didn't do much to keep them in the public's eye, but they did their part.
Absolutely. No, it was wonderful to see, and I'll forever think that it became a hit only because the Kingsmen, who were trying to imitate Richard Berry, weren't good enough to do it. And, you know, hence...
Yeah, They sure got the FBI involved.
Oh, wasn't that hilarious? And one of my favorite little radio contests was WTMA in Charleston, who said, send us a postcard, you know, and a self-addressed stamp envelope or whatever, and we'll send you all the four-letter words in Louie Louie. And they got, like, over 500,000 entries. And, of course, you know, they sent them back with ship and all that kind of stuff. So it was as you'd expect. But, yeah, the FBI investigated that and Puff the Magic Dragon while we're at it.
Well, what was the conclusion? Unintelligible at any speed, or something like that.
And it was.
They nailed it.
Yeah, yeah. It was. It was just terrible. And that was one of those. It's so bad, it's good.
The first pressing, the mistake pressing, was it was pressed up under the title of Louie Lovey, L-O-V-I-E, because
God.
I guess somebody at the pressing plant took it upon himself to decide no record could possibly have that title. And I discovered that original pressing at a house party I went to.
Oh, man.
And I was looking through the records, and there it was. And somehow that record disappeared. And then a few days later after that party, I discovered that some sneak thief had taken that record and put it in my record collection. I'll never know how that happened.
I won't either, but that's absolutely amazing. I love that. Well, and that takes me to your very first book, which I think was probably, I didn't even know you at the time you wrote it, but it was a wonderful book, Those Oldies But Goodies, A Guide to 50s Record Collecting. And you know, when we're talking 1973, of course there is no internet and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Val Shively sitting in his living room sending out mailing lists, and Lee's Dinette Music Center in Miami. I mean, you can count really on one hand the places you could go. So with that in mind, what caused you in 1973? I'm going to write a book about it.
Well, I had written an article on record collecting for a L.A. Times magazine that I submitted a manuscript, and they were about to buy it, and then the magazine folded, and I thought, well, heck, I'll send it to a publisher. My idea was people are literally throwing records away, and the more people throw records away, the less records there'll be for others to enjoy. So it was a way of trying to alert the public at large that their old records might be worth some money. I think it was the first effort at that, and it got me some threatening responses on the part of collectors who like to keep those things secret. Of course, me being one of them, I had to make the hard choice, you know, and so I went with the true scene, and it was. I'll tell you, I think the first book to detail the fact that old records are worth a few bucks.
Right, and it, like collecting anything, the stuff that's going to be worth the most money is not the big hit by Frank Sinatra or the Beatles. It's going to be the thing where there were, you know, six records, or the record was released and then it was pulled back, you know, like
right.
like the famous story about Berry Gordy and all that. You know, there are some that are the holy grails that I half wonder, do they exist? And I'm trying to think of it, what it was right now, but there was one record. Everybody said the 45 version of this is worth $1 million. And ultimately, I don't think there was a 45 version. I think it was only on 78. And you probably know the record I'm thinking of.
Well, there's several that meet that definition, but Rocket 88 by Jackie Brenson was one of them. When it came out, it was a 78 only, but then Chess used the original label design to reissue it on 45 after Bill Haley put out a version, and they were going to cover the cover, but that didn't work, so they put out very few copies of that. That's worth some serious money. The original Chess reissue in 1956 of a 1951 Chess label hit. Now you figure that one out.
Right. The Five Sharps, that was what it was. Stormy Weather.
Oh, Stormy Weather, sure.
On Jubilee. And I've seen it on 78, and the 45 was supposedly worth so much money. I've never seen that on 45, have you?
No, I don't think it exists, but bootlegs of it on 45 exist.
Oh, of course.
Various colored vinyl and all sorts of fantasy labels. So, Weather, the Five Sharps, the Times Square special.
Right, exactly. And a lot of things came out of Times Square, mostly courtesy of Jerry Green, actually. But the one I was thinking of, because John was going through my collection once, he said, oh my God, you've got a $35,000 record. Well, of course it was a boot, but it was Do I Love You, Frank Wilson. And that was another thing. I don't think a record's ever sold for more money in Great Britain than that. So obscurity sells.
I know how the record escaped from Motown.
Yeah,
it was a drug deal.
Was there an ex-wife involved in this?
No, there was a medical doctor who had access to Quaaludes, and the person that made sure the record left the label's archives had a liking for Quaaludes, and so that was a straight out trade. That's probably the world's rarest record, rarest 45, Northern Soul favorite.
Yes.
I interviewed Frank Wilson, and the reason it's rare, Berry Gordy was set to release that on Soul Records. It was a great record. And he came to Frank Wilson and said, you got a choice. You can either be a songwriter or a singer. And Frank chose songwriter, so Berry Gordy spiked the release, and that was it. So that I think two copies existed in the Motown files, and I think they both escaped and are floating around somewhere right now, probably in England.
Yeah, right, exactly, going for more than the price of a house. So,
or at least a cottage.
Well, right. And the stories are so great. Now, I haven't read every word of the book yet, so I don't know if you talked about him, but I'm sure you knew him. Kent Harris.
Oh, yeah, sure. Boogaloo.
Yeah, the original, and the Gallant Crew.
Yeah. Did the original Shopping for Clothes.
Yeah. Clothesline.
Lieber stole her and became... Well, it was Clothesline, right, by Boogaloo on Crest Records.
Right.
That was, Crest Records was a funny label. Eddie Cochran had his first, not his first appearance. Actually, he recorded for Dolphin, believe it or not, before that. But, you know that. But Eddie Cochran recorded for Crest. It was a label, they'd issue songs and hoping that they'd... be picked up so they could sell the publishing. They didn't intend for them to be hits. They intended for them to get noticed. So anyway, as Boogaloo, he recorded Clothesline for Crest Records, and he recorded Cops and Robbers.
Right.
It was later picked up by Bo Diddley.
So. Right. Wonderful song. And you mentioned Crest, and my favorite is still going to be Prince Partridge, How Come My Dog Don't Bark.
Yeah. Or God, what was Crest was a record label that featured songwriters doing their own compositions, hoping that they'd get picked up by a major label. But sometimes they got picked up, and the original songwriter was sort of left in the dust.
Well, that was a Shopping for Clothes, and that was one of those stories where Lieber and Stoller claimed that Billy Guy came to him and said, I heard this on the radio or whatever, and he just gave us a couple words, like all of them,
Well, yeah, but we'll change the title so it'll be ours.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Just these are all such great stories, and like you said.
I talked to Kent Harris. Let me interrupt for a second.
Tell me.
He, towards the end of his professional life, at least, he ran a swap meet, I think, near San Diego. I think in the Vista area, if I could be mistaken. But if you wanted to reach him, you had to call the payphone near his booth at the swap meet, and he'd answer the phone. So that's how I got an interview with him. And when he stopped answering, I had no other way of reaching him.
Yeah, he made it until a couple of years ago. I think he died like in 2019, but I thought this guy was just terrific and so underrated. And, when he called himself Boogaloo, that's long before anybody was boogalooing down Broadway. That's for darn sure.
He had his own label. Well, what was the name of his label?
Yeah.
He had a funk label and had some hits on that. And he was involved in setting up a chain of record stores in L.A., too.
Yeah. He was an entrepreneur in the true sense of the word. And
Dimples Harris was his sister, and he recorded her. And
Harris sisters, yeah.
And she, dig this, she was on Crest, too. I mean, it was the family got involved, so everybody was having a good time.
Great, great source. We're talking to Steve Probst, those old school records, 1,000 selected R&B, rock and roll, and soul 45 RPM singles. If you got any questions, I'm telling you, this is the guy who's got the answers. Don't ask me. Steve knows off the top of his head. And not put him on the spot here, but I guarantee you he'll live up to that if you call. 888-876-5593 is 8888 Raleigh on WGN Radio.
I was walking down the street minding my own affairs. Two policemen grabbed me unawares. They said, "Is your name Henry?" I said, "Oh, why, sure." They say, "You the boy we've been looking for." Put me in the lineup and let the bright light shine. Have a ten-pole soul like me standing in that line. I knew I was a victim of someone's evil plan when a stew pigeon walked in and said, "That's the man."
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and yeah, that's Bobby Nunn on lead. Of course, the Robins framed Lieber and Stoller. And of course, much has been written, including by Steve Probst, about the Robins prior to some of them becoming the Coasters. But afterwards, the Robins that remained, Ty Terrell and all, who went to Whip It and did all those things with Gene Norman, some of those records weren't bad. What did you think, Steve?
Oh, Cherry Lips was great.
Yeah.
You know, the Whip It label was designed after the RCA label.
Right.
Yeah.
Both dogs, yes.
he decided to rip off, what's the name
Nipper.
Of the
Nipper, yes, Nipper.
Yeah, and create his own Nipper. Yeah. So, you know, everybody was borrowing from everybody. Now, Framed, of course, was an answer record to Riot Cellblock number 9, and that gets us back to Richard Berry because he was hired as a temporary lead singer of the Robins to replace Bobby Nunn, who didn't sound menacing enough to take the lead on Riot and Cellblock number 9. And then Modern Records, who had Richard Berry under contract, found out that he went to another label and sang with the Robins. Of course, you couldn't miss it on Riot and Cellblock number 9, so they had him record The Big Break, which is a very weak variation on Riot and Cellblock number 9, so everybody was in on the act. Come on.
Yeah, it was the Wild West, and that would happen so often. You know, we start getting into Vibrations and Marathons and everything else over the years. It's the hour goes by too fast, so I have to ask you, I know you did an update of what was the first rock and roll record.
Right.
Has anything changed? Have we got another first?
No, we've still got the first 50 as we judge them, but I think that the debate carries on, which in fact was the first rock and roll record from blues and the Honey Dripper all the way up to Heartbreak Hotel. The choice is yours, dear reader. We just lay out the candidates,
and they are just great. And also, you have to define what you mean by rock and roll record, and if you're talking airplay involved and all that kind of stuff. So many arguments can be made, and you make all of them in there. So what are you working on now?
Working on trying to sell this book.
Okay.
Actually,
how do I help?
No, actually, I have another book on L.A. Rock and roll. Sort of, I've been dealing, you know, tinkering with this concept for quite some time, and you know, people that you wouldn't think of as part of the L.A. rock and roll scene, like Lalo Guerrero. Here's another one. Here's KFWB in 1959, the record by Bob Grabeau, Charge. Remember that one?
Yes.
Charge. Okay, they KFWB wrote a big disclaimer saying why it wasn't going to be charted because it only had what they call them topical interest for the moment. So they said it sold enough that we should chart it, but we're not going to chart it because it only has topical interest. Well, wait a second. KFWB is gone, and Charge lives on every
forever.
Time you go to Dodger Stadium. So,
amen. Now, hang on a minute, if you don't mind. I got a few more questions I want to ask before I let you go. Is that all right?
Okay.
All right, we'll pick it up right there with Steve Probst on WGN Radio.
All of it to you for all. and happiness is the answer. Got to take me with you, baby.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and yeah, I've heard all about Loveland. A lot of people have heard about Loveland. In fact, more people than Charles Wright was counting on, or maybe Charles Wright didn't know about it. We're going to talk about that soap opera. It's in those old school records, 1,000 selected R&B, rock and roll, and soul 45 RPM singles, 1946 to 87. Steve Probst wrote the book, and it is available. I assume it is available everywhere. Is that right, Steve?
Yeah, it's available from the publisher. It's available on Amazon. I haven't checked any local bookstores to see if it's available because we don't have any local bookstores anymore.
Yeah, I was going to say, what are you checking? Now, do you have a website?
Not really.
Okay. That's good. That's old school. All right. So,
it's a good idea, but yeah. No, not at the moment.
Well, that would take effort. But I'm talking about here Loveland, one of my all-time favorite records, which turned out is older than most people knew, older than Charles Wright claimed to know. What's the story?
Okay, the story is fairly straightforward, but sort of frustrating for Charles Wright. The song was brought to him by a group singer, L.A. group singer named Don Trotter, who had had was associated with the Untouchables, mm-hmm. the Valiants, those guys.
Yeah.
And he brought the song to Charles Wright. He had recorded it for Josie Records.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles liked the song, and he said he worked on it for months to try to get it the way he wanted it. It wasn't easy. And he rehearsed the guys, and it drove him crazy, and he almost gave up on it, but he kept plowing through, and finally came up with the arrangement he wanted, and they sang it the way he wanted, and boom, it came out, and it was a chart record, and he was performing it at concerts. He'd perform it, and then each concert he was at, a guy would come up to him and say, I want to talk to you about Loveland. And he'd sort of blow him off, and but finally he got tired of the guy approaching him, and so he said, okay, what's the problem? And he says, that song was first done by my uncle, and he didn't get any credit for it. And Charles took it to his lawyer, and the lawyer played him the original record by, of all people, Al Hibbler.
Right.
And Charles heard Al Hibbler's version and said, we're not going to fight this. It's his song. So he had to forego at least half the royalties to the Hibbler. I don't know if Al Hibbler was still alive at the time. I think he was, and he had to forego the royalties and the song that belonged to someone else. He wasn't too fond of Don Trotter after that, I'll tell you.
Oh, I guess not. And Trotter left and then did a sound alike to it, which was really strange.
Yeah, and I can't think of the name of it. But
it's for the best.
you know, we're talking about a lot of records.
Yeah.
The singer that was involved with Wright at the time took the song and did his own sound alike under a new name. I can look it up.
Right. I've got it on this computer, I know, but, you know, the song. But it does sound a lot, maybe it's on the computer in the other studio. But it was real weird because when I heard the Don Trotter follow-up, it's like, wait a minute, this is the same record.
Yeah, well, sure. That often happens when you hear the same record.
Right.
Let me see if I can find
it. Yeah, Kidnapper by Jewel and the Rubies, and that was a total rip, too, from, I'm trying to think of who the guy was. Well-known artist, too, one of the Don Robiacs.
Okay, here, I'll... create some dead air by looking it up.
Right, of course. Well, we could always listen to something. God knows there's a lot. And I did want to talk about Dory Records, too, because when I think of, L.A. R&B, of course, you know, you love the Leon Rene labels and the classes and all that. And you mentioned Crest and so many others. But Dory, to me, was like the most unlikely home for R&B, you know, Lou Bedell and Herb Newman. How did they get into that?
You know, it's a good question. I think they figured they could make some money. I mean, they made plenty of money on Zany's records, Beware of the Blob.
Right.
So, but I don't think that Beware. Okay, let me see here. James Gadson, Got to Find My Baby.
Right, right. That is it. That is it. Got to Find My Baby. It's the same record.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's, you know, it's that same vocal. So James
right.
Gadson was and continues to be a well-known soul and funk. That's funk, F-U-N-K, drummer.
Right,
and
right.
And when he left Charles Wright's band, he took the idea with him. So,
yeah.
But anyway, getting to Dory, my goodness.
Yeah.
In fact, the Whispers were originally on Dory. No,
that,
no,
yes, they were. And
they
that's,
were originally on Dory as the Whispers. They
yes.
were the Utopians.
Yes, but no, the Whispers stuff. I mean, you write about Never Again in the book, but there's so many things. And of course, the
yep.
thing about the Whispers, which you know, I'm sure you're well aware of this, but talk about bad timing. I mean, no one ever thought about the Whispers for quite a while. You know, Dory or Soul Clock or Janice or whatever. Yeah, right. So what? So here they come. They're about to have their first number one record, and one of them is arrested for robbery. You know, remember that? It was December 27th, 1979. And not only was it robbery, it was a jewel theft involving a mail truck.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to get some jewels, I think a mail truck. Well, maybe you should go for a Brinks truck. Too.
Right.
That
well,
done
yeah. well, apparently one of them knew somebody in the mail industry. But in any event, Legal Degree did about 4 months. He got the light sentence out of the guys. But you know,
okay.
I've thought about that to this day, is how could the timing have been worse? If that happened a year earlier, it wouldn't have even been a headline.
Oh, I see. Because who'd ever heard of this?
Right, right. And now they've got a number one record. I mean, here they're putting out record after record and some great stuff. I Was Born When You Kissed Me. I mean, there were just killer Dory records that no one ever heard of. And,
I get your point.
Yeah, yeah.
I get you. Timing is everything.
It is everything, yeah. Absolutely.
So,
well, great, great stuff. Now, John from Waukegan has a question, and I'm so glad to hear that. So, John, welcome back to WGN Radio.
Yes, I would like your guest to give me a few answers here. You was talking about the fathers of rock and roll. I heard it was Big Joe Turner.
Right.
Sure.
Big Mama Thornton.
Sure.
Hound Dog.
Chuck Berry.
Sure. Absolutely. All killer rightful names.
Yeah.
Nat King Cole. I heard he's just about Bill Cap. He was started singing right around the time that Capitol Records was.
Oh yeah, and Steve can back me up on this. The iconic building in Hollywood is known as the house that Nat built. Nat King Cole was everything, but you know he hated rock and roll.
Yeah, he had more of a pop and jazz vocal style. But the story of Nat Cole is sort of I don't know if it's instructive, but he was with a show. A black traveling show called Shuffle Along, and they showed up in the L.A. area, Long Beach, which is where I am right now and have been for a number of years, and they got stranded in Long Beach, and so he had the, you know, the show broke down. He was from Chicago, no way of getting back home, so he started singing local gigs and hooked up with labels here, and his career started because he ended up with Shuffle Along being closed down because they ran out of money, and that was best thing that ever happened to him.
Absolutely, and here's Capitol, which is a fledgling new label, and what a perfect relation. I'll tell you what, as you probably, Steve, know better than I, it certainly put Frank Sinatra's nose out of joint, and I think that's what started the Reprise label.
Yeah, Reprise. Like, yeah. It Reprisal.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yes. Jumping Stumpin', let me see. One more question about him. Him and his wife had a daughter, but didn't he adopt a son?
I thought it was a daughter that he adopted, but there are adopted kids in this, yes. And
Natalie
was his biological child, and they were had split for a while, but I think there were twin girls who were younger, I sort of know about this. Steve may know more than I do, but I lived in Hancock Park, and Nat King Cole's family were neighbors to us, and I think they totally had five kids ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I know Natalie was the oldest one, but I think there probably was a boy, but I thought it was the twins who were adopted, but I don't know. What do you know, Steve?
No, I'm not aware of Nat's family other than what you already. Interesting how what a small world it is, though, isn't it?
Well, what was really weird is they moved to Hancock Park, and it was just really awful because, this was a neighborhood that hadn't been integrated, although it was not all that far from neighborhoods that were, and neighborhoods that were predominantly African-American. But someone actually knocked on his doors to say, we don't want any undesirables here. And Nat, just cool as a cucumber, said, well, I don't either, and I'll let you know if I see any. So, Carol was the adopted girl, and I think Maria, as you probably know, John, his marriage was somewhat open, much to the chagrin of Maria, and Carol was the daughter of Maria's sister, and so she was adopted, but I'm trying to remember, because I do think there was a boy, but I was a girl, so I didn't know.
Wow, you got the story down.
Oh, okay. One more, and then I'm going to get out of your hair here. Jumping from classical music to blues, Little Walter, you have any information on him?
Well, he was, the dominant harmonica blues guy in the Chicago chess checker blues scene, and died at an early age. Pictures of him show a great big scar right across the middle of his face. So he was not afraid to get out there and enjoy the streets for what it's worth. Little Walter Jacobs was one of the guys that helped Chess Checker Records, along with Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, get started. So.
Yeah, he came to Chicago to sing. He didn't grow up there, John. He was from Louisiana, but I think it was, 16? Stevie came to Chicago with demos. And,
wow.
I think originally there was a deal. There's a little label on Maxwell Street. And, John, if you're really interested in early R&B in Chicago, look for labels like... what the heck was the name of this? It was right on Max. Oronel. Oronel. You would know well. And, there were people like Sonny Boy Williamson and Little Walter. And Little Walter joined Muddy Waters. And that's how we got to Chess.
And Muddy Waters had the first version of Rollin' and Tumblin'. It's in the first rock and roll record book.
Yeah.
Wasn't Oronel, I think it was on Parkway, and Chess had him re-record it, but the original version was just a killer version. And Rollin' and Tumblin' was issued on Herald Records under Little Walter's name, so everybody got a little piece of the action.
You're right, right.
Then Walter have some kind of way... do something with his harmonica, like electrified it or something, what they call it.
Well,
hooking it up to the...
I know that he did a lot of unamped stuff, but as far as...
Amplified.
Yeah,
I think he had the...
Later amplified.
Amplified harmonica.
Yeah, later.
Because he was jealous of the amplified guitar, so...
Right.
He just had his harmonica.
Right. And, recently, of course, with Tina dying, Ike Turner's been in the news, and it was Ike who tried to get Little Walter to go to modern. And he was actually thinking about doing it and wound up instead that he went to Checker.
Ike Turner recruited a whole lot of people for Modern Records and for Chess Records. He was a talent scout for both of them, and from Clarksdale, Mississippi, and originally came up to record Rocket 88 with Jackie Brinson.
Yeah.
So here's Tina, who passed away, big news. I mean, that continues to dominate the headlines. And people are sending me flyers when she used to appear in Long Beach, California. My favorite one so far was sent to me by a mutual friend, Raleigh Dave of Long Beach, who showed that she was performing, dig the name of this club, the Gay 90s.
Oh, yeah.
In Signal Hill.
Yes, yes, yes.
Let's go over to the Gay 90s and catch Tina Turner and her show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, at least she was Tina Turner. I mean, if the early stuff, she was Little Ann.
Little Ann, Box Top on Toontop Records.
Right, exactly.
Toontown Records. I have the single. It's pretty well worn, but I also have that alleged Chuck Berry single on Chuck Barrel.
Right. But John, you talk about Lil Walter. You know, when he was basically one of the Chess stable, you can hear his work on everybody from Bo Diddley to Shel Silverstein. I mean, it's across the board. Unfortunately, he had two problems. As Steve alluded, he never met an argument he wouldn't engage in. So there were violent altercations, but there was notorious temper, but notorious alcoholism. And that really was the problem in terms of terms of all that. But
but we dug his music, right?
Yeah.
Juke.
Tina Turner, when she moved to Switzerland, did she perform over there? Or
yes.
She just retired.
No. Originally, she went. Not only the boyfriend, but the other reason that she went there was because she was in so demand. And Steve might know more than me, but one of her tours over there probably made her richer than anything else she had done.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, it certainly made her richer than her parents at the Gay 90s.
Oh God! Well, that's right, and and you can also hear Little Walter on some Coco Taylor stuff too, if you're looking, John. So if you're interested, you got a lot of stuff.
Yeah, the session guys at Chess Records were world famous.
Yes, you betcha. Yeah.
And Willie Dixon backed up a lot of those sessions.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah. And another great, great writer, built for comfort. All right. So, John, thanks for calling.
Yeah, great question.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Right. Good night.
You too. Yeah, fun stuff. I could go on and on. So let's do this again, Steve. I know I'll plug it better so we get more calls, because literally people ask me things all the time, and half the time like, I don't know, but you will. So I hope hope it's a huge seller, those old school records. So
well, thank you. And anytime you have a question about a West Coast R&B song that, well, you know them all, so you don't need to come to me. But,
no, that's not true. Hey.
On the exceptional one that you don't know, just give me a buzz and I'll try to figure it out with you.
You knew Percy Ivy was in Chino. You're my hero tonight. I'm looking that up tonight later. We'll talk to you soon, and thank you for joining us.
Well, it was a pleasure.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So, Steve Propes, yeah. And like I say, I've got the whole list of books, and we can go through each one of them, from those oldies but goodies, A Guide to 50s Record Collecting, to the current, those old school records.